TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Michael Hudson and Paul Jay, Financialization and Deindustrialization. Paul Jay, the former CEO of the Real News Network, now is founder and publisher of TheAnalysis.News and president of Counterspin Films. On November 2, 2020, he interviewed the renowned economist Michael Hudson on TheAnalysis.News. Here are excerpts of their animated and far-reaching 49-minute discussion. Paul Jay and Michael Hudson began by discussing whether Trump policies have brought jobs and industries back home, as Trump still claims. They also discuss the huge and mounting COVID-related debt of ordinary people and the need for writing it down, and the difference in the amounts of support in the COVID stimulus plan, with about $8 trillion going to the 1% and $2 trillion to the rest of us. Here's Paul Jay.
Hi, I'm Paul Jay, and welcome to the Analysis.News podcast. Donald Trump has tried very hard to make this election about his pre-pandemic economic record, which is supposed to be a success story. Cyclical upswing of the economy started during the last Obama years. Trading skills have brought hundreds of thousands of jobs back to the United States. Well, the Wall Street Journal reported on October 26 that, quote, President Trump's trade war against China didn't achieve the central objective of reversing a U.S. decline in manufacturing, economic data show, despite tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars of Chinese goods to discourage imports. The tariffs did succeed in reducing the trade deficit with China in 2019, but the overall U.S. trade imbalance was bigger than ever that year and has continued climbing, soaring to a record $84 billion in August as U.S. importers shifted to cheaper sources of goods from Vietnam, Mexico, and other countries. The trade deficit with China also has risen amid the pandemic and is back to where it was at the start of the Trump administration. Another goal, reshoring of U.S. factory production, hasn't happened either. Job growth in manufacturing started to slow in July 2018, and manufacturing production peaked in December 2018. Manufacturing job growth began to slow when the trade war started and had nearly stopped growing before the pandemic. So why is there so little industrial growth in spite of all of Trump's rhetoric? Well, now joining us to help answer that question is Michael Hudson. He's an economist, a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a researcher at the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College. He's also a former Wall Street analyst, a political consultant, a commentator, and a journalist. Thanks very much for joining us, Michael.
Well, it's good to be back with you.
So Trump made all kinds of promises and is still blowing his horn about this issue of returning jobs and rebirth of American industrial manufacturing, but he hasn't succeeded. Why? And there's some bigger reasons for that, aren't there?
Well, we've talked about these bigger reasons for quite a few years now. And my point is that the economy's been in a slow crash right along. And the reason is that in order to become an industrial economy, you have to lower the cost of living and lower the cost of doing business. That's what the whole fight of classical economics was all about. But as the economy's more and more financialized and polarized, it's impossible to cut costs. You mentioned the pandemic, and healthcare now absorbs 18% of the GDP. And if you look at the other cost, if you're a wage earner, 15% of your income right off the bat goes for Social Security and medical insurance. You have regular taxes of anywhere about 20%. You have mortgage debt that is up to about 40%, 43% of average income. At least that's what the U.S. government is willing to guarantee when bankers make a loan. And you have other loans. You have student debt to pay for an education in order to get a job. You have automobile debt to get to the job. And when you add up all of these...
Add credit card debt to that.
Absolutely. Credit card debt's been stable, but although the volume of debt, credit card debt's been stable, as people are falling further and more into arrears, their interest rate jumps from about 18% to 29% or more. So the same amount of debt now absorbs a much larger part of your income. So the result of all this is that if American workers in industry got all of their food, all of their clothes, all of their transportation, everything, all of the physical goods and services they use for free, they still couldn't compete. In fact, if they just had to pay their wage withholding for Social Security, medical care, and overall health insurance alone, that is larger than the wage levels in Asia where we're importing things from. So the fact is that the United States has made itself uncompetitive because of this idea that, well, it wants to get rich, and the way to get rich is to go further and further into debt to buy houses that are rising in price. But as houses rise in price, then you have to pay more and more debt service or more and more rents to people who buy the same houses on debt. And the result is that America's priced out of the market. Well, this is what Ricardo talked about in his free trade theory way back in 1817. He said that industrial capitalism was not going to be able to take off in England if British workers had to pay rising rents as food prices rose behind the agricultural tariffs that England had. And there was a 30-year fight to finally repeal the agricultural tariffs, the corn laws. And Ricardo said, if you don't stop the economy from having to pay the rentier class, at that time the landlords, then this, you're going to have the Armageddon of capitalism. You're going to have the Day of Judgment, that rents are going to rise to take so much of the wage earner's income and the industrialist's income that there's no room left for profit. And basically, if you're going to compete with other countries and try to sell or buy American goods instead of imports, then you're going to have to pay enormously high costs to pay the rentier class, which is basically the 1%, the finance, insurance, and real estate sector, the fire sector. And instead of becoming an industrial economy, the United States has become a fire sector economy. And Trump has not done anything at all to reduce that. The economy is getting obviously sicker and sicker once again. Medical costs are going up. The states and municipalities are broke. Small business has been going out of business. So where is the demand going to be for domestic American manufacturing? And why would one pay for manufacturers with labor that's cost 10 or 20 times what it costs abroad when you add up all of these rentier costs into the equation? It can't be done.
Well, there seems to be different parts to the argument, and they kind of all lead to the same conclusion, a continued lack of industrial jobs in the United States. But let's start with, in the article, it's kind of an obvious thing. In spite of the tariffs against Chinese imports, these American corporations on the whole that were producing in China, a lot of them just moved to other cheap wage economies. They're talking here in Vietnam and Mexico. So the actual balance of trade didn't change at all.
That's right. American corporations are going global and multinational, and they're going to hire labor wherever it's cheaper than American labor. And that's almost everywhere in the world, because no other country in the world has to pay American-style health insurance. No country in the world has to pay residential rents that are charged in the United States. Other countries just don't have the heavy financial overhead structure that the United States has. And so there's no way in which these multinational firms are going to produce in the United States.
The Trump plan and the Republican plan, in spite of all the demonization of China as being the source of all evil, and including the virus itself, never mind taking away industrial jobs, which is all a process. The outsourcing was obviously all an American driven process, the American corporations, leads to this kind of dead end, because the more American workers' wages and living standards go down, the less they can buy. So even if you're producing cheaply abroad, your market is still getting smaller in the United States.
Yes, the living standards are going down, but not the wages.
Not the cost of living, just the standard of living.
Right.
And we're seeing this even in the fight over what to do in the pandemic moment. The Republicans are against another big stimulus plan. The Democrats supported the original couple of plans, but they also supported so much of those plans actually going to defend the cost of assets or the value of assets of the rich. More went that way, if I understand it correctly, than actually went to workers and working families as subsidy.
We're talking about $8 trillion to the 1%, $2 trillion to the rest of the population. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats made a deal with the Republicans. They both agreed that they wanted to pay their respective campaign contributors, the financial sector and the real estate sector. They wanted to use the pandemic. They were realistic. We can't save the economy. We can save the stock market. Let's give it $8 trillion into the stock market and the bond market, and let's save the banks. Let's have the Federal Reserve use some of this $8 trillion to buy the packaged mortgage loans, the packaged oil industry loans, the loans that are going bad. So let's bail out the rich people. Neither the Republicans nor the Democrats really cared about the working class. I think Trump had some care for the working class, but the other Republicans didn't. And the Democrats were said, look, what we'll promise the workers that, oh, we'll get to this, the fact we know that the states and localities are broke. We know that the subways are running at a deficit. We know that the cities are broke and they're going to have to lay off people. So we really can't deal with that. Let them go under. Nancy Pelosi said, well, we'll get to all that later. And she knew very well that she wouldn't get to that later, and that she wouldn't even agree when Trump said, well, let's at least send out another $2 trillion in the $1,200 checks to everybody. She wouldn't even agree to that. So the Democrats have come out really to the right of the Republicans, or they've made a right-wing shift.
I don't think you can say to the right of the Republicans, but they sure are.
Well, it's almost impossible to say. You're right. Let's just say nobody really cared about labor or has made any proposals, because in order to deal with the employment problem and the industrial problem, you'd have to restructure the economy. The economy structures now isn't simply a question of not having enough money to live or enough money to buy goods and services or enough profit. It's that it's so malstructured that the industrial economy and the wage labor has been absolutely flat for decades now in the big picture, and all of the growth of income, certainly since 2008, all of the growth in wealth has accrued just to the top 10%. It's accrued in the form of rising stocks and bonds and housing prices, but rising housing prices don't make it easy for wage earners, because new workers have to pay more and more for the homes that go up. So instead of making the economy richer, this boom in stock prices and also the stock and bond market is making the economy more debt strapped. And if you're a pension a worker expecting a pension, the pension funds are only able to make less than 1% on risk-free capital. So they're taking a lot of risks, and they're usually taken advantage of by the sharpies on Wall Street that sell them derivatives, as occurred with CalPERS, the California pension fund group. And I don't see any way out of it without either writing down the debts, certainly for the debts run up during the pandemic, writing down the rents that have been, just forgiving them, that have accrued. Because if you leave the last 6 months of rents in place and debts in place, then you're going to try to start any kind of recovery after the virus is over with this huge backload of rent hanging over you, the huge backload of debt service. And there's no way that a lot of companies can stay in business, the fracking industry, for instance. And there's no way that a lot of workers can avoid being laid off, especially if they're public employees for cities and states or public agency employees like New York City Transit Authority says, well, we're going to have to lay off our transit workers because we don't have enough money to pay because they haven't been taking public transit in the pandemic, and we've had to pay labor, we've had to pay our bondholders. Obviously, something has to give, and I think the Democrats and Republicans are in agreement that what gives is going to be labor's economic conditions, not those of their respective campaign contributors.
Well, let's say you got a phone call, and I have absolutely no doubt, and I there's very few things I have no doubt about, but I have no doubt you will not get this phone call. But let's say you do. And Biden calls you and said, okay, I've been listening to you, and okay, what is, you're talking about restructuring, so what should I do? And I know Biden's not going to call you, but What should a Biden administration do?
Well, it's
a very, very critical, dangerous moment in so many ways.
Well, you're personalizing it. And the problem is, what could any president do? The tax laws are made by Congress. And you've seen with Donald Trump, it doesn't matter what he tries to do. It wouldn't matter who's president coming in, because one of the things that's needed to do is to write down the debts that are owed to the banks. The economy cannot recover when it's working under this debt burden. Many people have talked about at least start by writing down student loan debt with the huge default rates there are now. As long as you leave the student loan debt in place, students are not going to be able to qualify for mortgage loans. So they can't buy houses of their own because they're already pledging too much of their income to pay
student loan debt. Debt's around $1 trillion, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's larger now than credit card debt. And you can't wipe, thanks to the bankruptcy law that Mr. Biden put in, you can't wipe out the student debt with bankruptcy. I mean, it was really Mr. Biden, much more than Donald Trump, that has screwed up the economic system by what he did in sponsoring the laws. He was the senator from Delaware, which is basically the money, the bank, the corporate banking state. And they called him the senator from the credit card companies. And he represented the credit card companies against labor. His whole career has been fighting against labor. And it's inconceivable that he would ever call someone like me any more than he said it on 60 Minutes on Sunday. He said, you know, people think that I'm going to be like Bernie or AOS, but I beat those guys. You'll never call me a socialist. And when Kamala Harris was asked if she was a socialist or a left-winger, she just laughed and laughed and said, how could anyone possibly believe that? And of course, if you look at what she did in California by supporting Mnuchin in all of his fraudulent evictions, she supports the real estate owners, even when they're illegally acting against the renters. So neither of them are a friend of labor. So what they would call me is saying, what we need is a patter talk from you, Mr. Hudson. We know.
Well, don't take the phone call thing too seriously. but what I'm getting at is, you know, let me frame this differently. A progressive people's movement and the progressives that have been elected to Congress, what should they be demanding? What do real solutions look like?
What they should be demanding is something that cannot be done within the existing two-party system. They should say, first of all, the way to keep down housing prices is to get the cities and states out of their deficit is to tax the unearned income, tax the land, have a real estate tax that'll collect all this rent that is being paid right now to the banks as mortgage interest. Either you pay the banks the contractual interest that they're due on all of these loans and you go broke, or you let the banks, basically you realize the banks have become adverse to economic welfare. You have to let the financial system go and replace it with banking and credit as a public utility. That's what makes China so competitive. Why is China able to outstrip American labor, where that the Chinese have almost an I'd say an equal standard of living from everything that I've seen there. Well, the reason is that China's doing exactly what the United States did to become an industrial power in the late 19th century. China has public utilities, public enterprises, providing basic needs and basic public services at a subsidized rate or freely, such as education. Free. There's no foreign labor doesn't have education debt like the United States. Education's free. Healthcare is public. It's provided freely. There's no huge.
Let me say, I think that's not quite as rosy as it appears.
Right. Not quite. Oh, you're right. Not quite as rosy.
Because my understanding is that while healthcare is supposed to be free and public, that you actually have to wind up having to pay doctors some cash or you really can't get in to see them.
Yes, that is a fact. I do acknowledge that fact. But the most important public utility, to answer the question that you brought up, the important thing is that banking and finance in China is a public utility. The government is the creditor. And so when there's a pandemic like this and companies cannot afford to pay the debts, or have to lay off labor, the government as banker can say, okay, we're just not going to collect the debt and force you to go under and force you to lay off your labor force. And it's easy to cancel debts when you, the public, the government, are the creditor, because you're canceling debts owed to yourself. And that's one of the main reasons why banking should be a public utility. And in the United States—
Well, in some ways, banking is a public utility if you're a big bank or if you're a big corporation, because the Fed actually did essentially give corporations and banks so much cash during the pandemic, they were able to pay off their debts.
Absolutely.
So it kind of is a public utility for if you're in the 1%.
Yes, you're right. What I meant is a public utility serving the public interest. And this is a public utility that obviously who is going to control the state? And that really is the key. Will it be progressives that control the state, or will it be the 1%?
The ability of the major financial corporations and large corporations, although I think finance is by so far the dominant force, right. Because if you look who owns almost all of the major corporations, the majority owners are big financial institutions. The majority
That's
of
right.
shares are held by big banks and in particular by asset management companies like BlackRock and State Street and Vanguard, but not only them, there's others. And the power that the financial institutions wield over government is what Roosevelt defined as fascism. He said this when one sector of the economy, one group of companies essentially controls or owns the government, that's fascism, and we are virtually, or we are there.
You're quite right. You're absolutely right. That is the problem. We are in a centrally planned economy, but the central planning is done on Wall Street, not in Washington. And the state, now that you've essentially privatized and financialized the political process, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations are people and corporations can buy control of the political process. So that's basically what the problem is. Let's get back to fascism, because that's very important. Around the time that Roosevelt made that comment, Trotsky analyzed fascism in Germany and Italy. And he said that fascism is what occurred when the socialists don't have a solution to the problems. And so you could say that I think we are indeed emerging in that kind of fascism today, because you don't have the left or in the progressive interests really coming up with a solution to the problems. And that's because this the only kind of solution is so radical that it can't be solved within the existing political framework and the existing legal framework. There has to be the equivalent of a revolution. And if it's not going to be an anti-fascist revolution, then it'll be a fascist revolution. And what we're seeing is that kind of a slow revolution. And as Warren Buffett said, there is a war and we're winning, but we seem to be the only people that know that the war is on. and the war is on, and we're moving towards an economy by the 1%. And I mean, fascism basically is the integration of corporations in the state, leaving out the voters and the working class. It's a corporate state. And as you pointed out, we're not simply a corporate state here. Otherwise, at least the industrialists would be trying to run the economy to promote industry. We're in a financialized state. And that's finance capitalism, which is very different from the industrial capitalism. And many of the left, especially the Marxists, still talk about industrial capitalism as being the problem. And yet industrial capitalism is being phased out in the United States, as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, and it's being phased out by finance capitalism. And that isn't even being discussed here, either by the media or even on the left. There's not much discussion of it.
But this issue of public banking, I think, is critical. And I think it needs to be focused on, because it's not nearly enough in the focus of the demands of the progressive movement and like in the Green New Deal and other places. The breaking the hold of finance over the government, and I don't see how that happens without public banking. There's still a lot of talk about breaking up the big banks and regulation. And breaking up the big banks probably is a good thing, but it's only really works if at the same time you build public banking on a large scale, diverse ownership. It could be owned at federal level, states, cities, regions, cooperatives, co-op banks. But you need something on a scale that when the big banks try to threaten, too big to fail, a government needs to be able to say, well, you're not to, go off and fail. You can't blackmail us anymore because we have a real public banking system. The demand, I think, needs to be raised far more forcefully.
Well, the problem is, what kind of banking are you going to have? And the whole tradition of American and British banking has been to lend against assets. So banks will not make a loan unless you have collateral to pledge. And the collateral is going to be assets and property that's already in place, mainly mortgages on real estate, but also it could be stocks and bonds or other assets. Banks don't lend to finance industry building new capital. They'll lend to corporate raiders who will buy out industry. They will lend to the what you call the industries you cited, and that includes the high-tech industries. This isn't the old kind of industrial capitalism industry. These are monopolies, and Amazon and the other Apple and Google make their money off monopoly rent.
Sorry to interrupt this amazing discussion between program host Paul J. of theanalysis.news and Michael Hudson, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a researcher at the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College. He's also a former Wall Street analyst. Paul J. is the founder and publisher of theanalysis.news. He's a journalist and filmmaker. Paul J. and Michael Hudson spoke on November 2, 2020, on financialization and deindustrialization. The full 49-minute conversation is free on the website of theanalysis.news, and there's also a transcript. This program was produced by TUC Radio and can be heard anytime, free, on the archives at tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.